From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Friday, July 14th, 2017. And on this day, the Malaga community, which was evicted from its home island and had several members forcibly committed, gets a permanent memorial. And we'll check in on the ongoing transparency issues around the campaign to get a casino in York County. That's ahead in a moment.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners like you and by USM's Muskie School of Public Service Master of Public Health Program, preparing students for today's complex population health and health services needs.
A slow response to subpoenas and disputes over documents could delay the investigation into the controversial campaign seeking to convince voters to support a casino in York County. The State Ethics Commission took votes today to modify its request for correspondence and bank records that it hopes will help determine whether the campaign has disclosed its true funding sources. Political correspondent Steve Missler is here to update us on the latest developments. So, Steve, this has been going on for quite some time. Before we get into what happened today, can you just remind us, give us a little background about why the Maine Ethics Commission is investigating this campaign?
Sure. So I think it's important to step back even further than that. This campaign has been operating since 2015, and controversy has followed this campaign at seemingly every turn. First, it was denied ballot access last year after some signature irregularities were discovered by the Secretary of State. It's now back on the ballot. And since then, we've been trying to figure out who is funding this thing. Up until recently, Lisa Scott, who is the sister of Sean Scott, a casino developer with ties to Maine, has been the sole funder of this campaign. And Sean Scott, of course, is a controversial figure who brought gambling to Maine, to Bangor in 2003, and has left a trail of litigation across the country and internationally ever since. We've always assumed that Sean Scott was involved with the Horse Racing Jobs Fairness campaign, but neither he nor his affiliates have appeared on any finance reports up until recently.
And we reported it at that time in April that the Horse Racing Jobs Fairness campaign updated its funders, right?
Yeah, that's right. So up until April, the campaign reported over $4 million in contributions to Sean Scott's sister, Lisa Scott. That's a lot of money, and these guys haven't even run a single ad yet. That was just to get on the ballot. But what we learned in April is that there's this complex web of domestic and offshore investment firms funneling money to Lisa Scott, who's then in turn funneling that money to the campaign. Most of these companies are linked in some way to Sean Scott or his associates. Now, this is important not only because Scott and his associates have a checkered past, but also because our campaign finance laws are designed to let the public know who is attempting to persuade them. That's the whole point of campaign disclosure, to give voters the opportunity to know who and why somebody wants their support.
And that's why the Ethics Commission is investigating the campaign?
Yeah. So back in June, the commission voted to probe the campaign for two reasons. First, to determine whether the updated finance reports reveal all the campaign funders. And second, the commission wants to determine whether the campaign should be slapped with a really hefty fine for hiding its funding sources for over a year.
Okay. And today the commission voted to modify their request for records.
Basically, the commission wants to get this investigation done before voters go to the polls in November and vote on the casino initiative. So at the end of the day, the commission is trying to limit disputes, including a potential legal one, over the records it's requested, while also getting the records it needs to close the investigation in a timely manner. Right now, that investigation will be pushed out until at least September, which means the commission may not have any findings until voters have already begun to cast ballots, especially when we have absentee balloting, or worst-case scenario, after the election.
That's our political correspondent, Steve Missler. More than a century after a mixed-race community of fishermen and laborers was forcibly evicted and virtually erased from Malaga Island off the coast of Phippsburg, their descendants now have a permanent memorial. Today, Governor Paul LePage joined those descendants and their supporters at Pineland Cemetery for its dedication and to begin the healing of what many consider to be one of the darkest chapters in Maine's history. Susan Sharon has more.
The memorial's inscription lays out most of the facts. In 1912, a community of 45 black and white residents who married and lived together were ordered to give up the homes that they'd inhabited for 50 years. The state then took ownership of Malaga Island, and their houses were burned to the ground. Caught up in a eugenics movement that considered them inferior, 8 of the residents were sent to the Maine School for the Feeble-Minded in New Gloucester. And says Kate McBrien of the Maine Historical Society, even the bodies in the island cemetery were removed.
What happened was, after the state evicted the community, a few months later, in November of 1912, the state went back and they exhumed all the bodies out of the cemetery on Malaga Island, combined 17 bodies into 5 caskets, as best we can tell, and buried them here.
Here is the Pineland Cemetery in New Gloucester, not far from where the School for the Feeble-Minded once stood. Now in its place is a large granite memorial with the names of the people whose graves were relocated and the names of those who were confined to the school and died there.
On behalf of the people of Maine, our apologies to you and to your families, to your ancestors.
Speaking to a small crowd assembled for the memorial's dedication, Governor LePage once again apologized for the state's treatment of the residents of Malaga Island, something he first did 5 years ago on the 100th anniversary of the eviction. Since then, LePage has created a scholarship fund for descendants to attend college, and he led the effort to establish the memorial, which he says can never make up for what occurred.
This memorial today only begins to make the healing of that terrible, terrible time.
For decades, the story of Malaga Island was so buried that many descendants themselves weren't aware of it. Others were ashamed to talk about it. But about 15 years ago, research by historian Kate McBrien helped to connect the dots and the people. The descendants now refer to themselves as cousins and keep in touch through a Facebook group.
The family now has, they're here today, and they're happy to be here today.
Marnie Darling Voder of Windham says she first discovered she was related to freed slave Benjamin Darling back in 1974. Her genealogist husband helped her uncover the truth about her heritage during a trip to the library.
It might be one little black thread, but it was in me. It was a we shall overcome moment. I was proud.
As a white woman living in one of the whitest states in the country, Voder says she was proud, but she says her father forbade her to discuss their roots. Now she has several dozen other people to share it with, people like 13-year-old James Richardson, who came up from Connecticut with other family members to visit his ancestors' graves in person. They were among the people in the cemetery whose bodies were exhumed.
Like, I hope that makes them, like, rest in peace and know that everything's going to be okay now and that their people are sorry for what happened and knows about what's happening.
Richardson says he was happy to see a headstone that showed his great-great-grandfather and grandmother buried together. Others say they are just happy to have a permanent reminder of why it's necessary to speak out against injustice and not wait 100 years to do it. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Susan Charon.
And finally, tonight, our latest installment in our Once Upon a Job series, where we look at some of the region's increasingly rare skills. Today, we catch up with a man from Wiscasset who, come April, is one of the busiest guys you're likely to meet.
It's sun up to sundown. You know, usually I don't get home until the kids are asleep.
That's Jeff Birchstead. And from April to July, he spends 7 days a week on the road, traveling from farm to farm, where he'll spend 16-hour days bent over, shaving down well over 1,000 sheep, all by himself.
It's a pretty self-limiting occupation. You know, it can be hard on your body. So you do have to have, you know, you have to have a strong back. You have to be, you know, physically in good shape.
Sheep shearing is not for everyone. Birchstead says it requires just the right temperament and the right touch.
You know, I always tell people it takes about 100 sheep before you kind of know what you're doing. You kind of have a feel for the sheep themselves and then maybe the pattern that you follow. It probably took 1,000 sheep before I felt like I could go anywhere and shear any sheep where I didn't have the butterflies in my stomach as I pulled into the barnyard.
In the 19th century, when sheep outnumbered Mainers almost 2-1, a lot of people would have known how to shear. Today, the Maine Sheep Breeders Association knows of only about a dozen people in Maine who can shear, but only half of those do it full-time. It's not uncommon for shearers to travel to Maine from Massachusetts, Vermont, and New Hampshire on a circuit, shearing as they go. Basically, says Birchstead, a New England shearer can be as busy as he or she wants to be. Shearers negotiate a basic travel fee, and then they're paid for work on each sheep. Birchstead gets $7 for each shave down and another $3 if they want him to trim the animal's hooves.
Come on, Bessie, it's all right.
This farm in Sumner, called A Wrinkle in Time, is the first of 6 Birchstead is hoping to get to today. So with the clock ticking, he doesn't dally.
He does the belly first. And the belly wool is shorter and dirtier, and that goes into the compost bin.
Marty Elkin is one of the owners of the farm. She and her partner are happy to pay Birchstead to denude their small flock of 32 Romney Corriedale crosses. What would take them about an hour per sheep, he can do in just 5 minutes. Birchstead shaves down the lower legs and then proceeds to the sweet meat, the thick, kinky fleece attached to the rest of the ewe. He passes the clippers from breastbone to neck to chin and head, working his way systematically under a puffy parka of wool.
Now he's gone clear along the spine, all the way up the back of the neck to the ears, and he does 3 or 4 or 5 swipes that way.
Look at that, and then just gradually a sheep is emerging from all that fluff.
A beautiful white sheep with a little bit of pink showing through.
Just a few more passes with the clippers.
Coming to up on the tail. And we're almost done, and we're done.
Like any good shearer, Birchstead has removed the whole fleece in a single piece, like a shirt, with no cuts or nicks to the sheep's delicate skin. The wool will be combed, washed, and sorted, eventually to be sold to a local yarn maker to supply a growing artisanal fiber arts industry. The process is much the same as it would have been in centuries past, when wool was big business in Maine.
You know, there were millions of sheep in New England and in Maine. And, I mean, that's why Maine looks like it does right now, is because of sheep.
As he trims hooves, Birchstead explains that all those low stone walls that crisscross southern Maine and much of the open green space you see are the legacy of long-ago sheep farmers who raised the animals for meat, milk and cheese, leather, and, of course, fiber.
And it was one of the things that we, you know, wanted independence from England for, was to be able to sell our own wool.
But times change. The demand for natural fiber is a lot lower than it once was. Raw commodity wool in recent years has seen prices as low as 20 cents per pound. In the 1940s, it was still fetching $1 per pound. And modern tastes have skewed toward beef and cow's milk and away from the sheep products that once sustained New Englanders. Birchstead says he doesn't think Maine fields will ever be home to 1 million sheep again. But he says there are hopeful signs that as more small farms pop up every year in Maine, there's still work for people like him. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Jennifer Mitchell.
For more of today's Maine news, visit our website, mainepublic.org. And from Maine Public, that's This Day in Maine, Friday, July 14th, 2017. Thanks to Ed Morin and our digital team, I'm Nora Flaherty.